Do you say to yourself, well, I really serve the public best by trying to contain the situation, which also means that the public isn't in a position to evaluate what's taking place here? Now, we don't know everything the president is currently scheming to do. If you read this David Ignatius column in the Washington Post the other day, you know, he's suggesting that there's all sorts of other plotting that may be taking place there that sources tell him about. Well, we shouldn't be reading about it in the David Ignatius column. If that's taking place, people of good conscience in the White House should call the president out on it, refuse to continue to serve, and make it clear what's taking place.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 29th, 2020. Bob Bauer is a longtime Lawfare contributor. He's also a former White House counsel, and you've probably seen his name in the news of late because he's been leading the legal response for the Biden campaign and transition to the unprecedented onslaught of efforts on the part of the president to overturn the 2020 election. He somehow found time in the midst of all of that to write a piece for Lawfare on the current occupant of the White House counsel's office, Pat Cipollone, and how he should be handling the incredibly difficult position the president has put him in. Bob joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about the article, to talk about the role of the White House counsel when the president is trying to overturn a Democratic election, to talk as well about the spate of pardons the White House has issued over the last few weeks. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 29th, Bob Bauer on the White House counsel in an anti-democratic moment. So, Bob, I want to start with the what I think for many readers and listeners is going to be the obvious question, which is, where is there time in your day right now to write a reflective, serious article on the current occupant of the White House counsel's office? Aren't you like busy saving the Republic and all that?
Well, that's a good question. And to be honest with you, I really don't remember the last number of things that you can ask me. How is it that I did it? And I don't recall, but somehow I got it done.
So for those who have not read this article, I want to say it is incredibly generous to Pat Cipollone, not in the sense that it's a kind of Washington insider, hey, pay into the current holder of an office that I used to hold, but in the sense that it genuinely tries to look at things from his point of view in a period in which you're spending your day fighting not exactly with that office, but with the forces that that office is also representing. And I commend it all as a, you know, among other things, an act of negative capability on your part to sort of put yourself in his shoes right now. And you start with the observation that he has not always been a good actor in that role. And so I want to ask you to sketch out the good and the bad of Pat Cipollone as White House counsel. What are the parts that are not admirable, and what are the parts that you find place to admire?
I'd begin by saying I'm working, as everybody is, with incomplete information. And so one of the reasons I want to be as generous as possible in my appraisal of his performance is that I have only so much visibility into what it's like to work for Donald Trump. I have some, because I've read the Mueller report, and I've read a good bit about his relationship to Don McGahn and to other lawyers in his administration. So I have some sense of what the current White House counsel must be grappling with. But I don't know so much that I can be highly, highly critical, or, you know, for that matter, you know, can understand all of the trade-offs that he thinks he might be making in that position, maybe placating Donald Trump one day on one issue so he can win what he thinks is a larger battle the next. I do believe that there are trade-offs that White House counsel should not be prepared to make, and so I've been critical of him in that respect. His performance during the impeachment process was one that I criticized, and I think I did so in a couple of pieces in Lawfare. He may have been catering to the president, but he adopted extremely harsh political rhetoric some of the letters that he sent to the Congress to protest, for example, what he thought the House procedures were letters that I don't think lawyers ought to write generally, but in his case in particular, as a government lawyer, he came across more as a counsel to the Trump campaign or a personal lawyer to Donald Trump than he came across as a lawyer for the U.S. government, a White House counsel whose responsibility is ultimately to the American public. And so I thought that his performance there, both in tussling with the House and on the floor of the Senate, left a good bit to be desired, and I didn't think reflected well on his office. At the same time, one reads that, for example, recently he's been trying to dissuade the president from listening to the likes of Sidney Powell and Mike Flynn. I certainly think he should be commended for that. That's setting the bar somewhat low, but we can be grateful that he did it and that he's attempting to stop the president from continuing to scheme around the election results that he doesn't like. So that is, I suppose, on opposite ends, one criticism, one a bit of praise, but again, in an environment of somewhat less than complete information.
So I want to pick up on the point you just made that this is setting the bar low to say that he pushed back against Michael Flynn's explicit suggestion that there should be the invocation of martial law or, you know, the seizure of ballots by ballot machines by the military. And Sidney Powell's suggestion, I actually don't even know how to parse what she's suggesting. It's barely in English, let alone comprehensible English. You know, he's a sort of longtime white shoe Washington lawyer. How much credit should he really get for having a limit if he's willing to send the letter to Congress that sounds like, you know, a MAGA press release, but he's not willing to go Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani level crazy? Is that a line that we should admire, or is that a line that says, I don't know, like there are pretenses that must be kept up or something? I mean, how do you evaluate that line?
In the piece, I suggest that there comes a point where not doing what you should be doing in order to win a different battle on a different day is not always a sustainable job performance. That is to say, it's not always an excuse to say, I behaved the way I did in impeachment because I had no choice but to be strident, or I would have lost the confidence of the client. But you have no idea how many days I had to spend dissuading him from doing something that would have been absolutely catastrophic. That's a good thing for someone to do in that position, to prevent the president from doing something absolutely catastrophic. But that does not mean that he has to pay in lavish coin for that at some considerable expense to the office. There comes a point where a White House counsel has to ask himself or herself the question, is this a president I should continue to serve? Should I remain in this position? And there are a couple of aspects of this. One of them is that because the White House counsel is a government lawyer, there are acts of witness, if you will, that I think he or she may be responsible for in extreme cases. That is to say, leave an office and make it very clear why it is that the office is no longer a tenable one to hold. That there are certain things that ought not to be obscured. You may have seen the op-ed that Sarah Isger, who used to be in the Department of Justice working on press relations in the most senior position for Jeff Sessions, she came to the conclusion that senior officials of the Trump administration who had decided that they should stay on to prevent harm, also contributed to obscuring from public view the seriousness of the problems with the administration. And on balance, she concluded that they made the wrong choice. Now, again, everything is fact specific. It depends on the context, what harm precisely they're obscuring from public view. But I asked that same question, I think, and I think it should be asked of every White House counsel, and it certainly should be asked of the current White House counsel. What are the limits of what you're willing to put up with? What are the limits of the trade-offs that you're prepared to make? I do think that persuading the president not to launch an undemocratic coup d'etat is a good thing, but perhaps the public ought to know that he will not be in the building representing on behalf of the public a president who would consider an undemocratic or a democratic coup d'etat. And if it is in fact true, and we only know this from press reports, that the president of the United States was actively considering deploying the military to overturn the outcome of an election he didn't like, Is there a White House counsel to be applauded for talking him out of it or helping to talk him out of it? Or would we prefer the White House counsel to just simply leave the building and say why? So we're all aware of what's taking place and we're not simply relying on press reports.
So it seems to me that Don McGahn performed two distinct services in his role in that office, neither of them fully appreciated at the time. One was that he refused to carry out a bunch of obstructions of justice that the president contemplated. But the other was that he functioned as a kind of real-time conduit of information, sometimes tasked by law enforcement in the form of the Bob Mueller investigation, about the president's behavior to a active investigation. And, you know, one of my questions about Pat Cipollone, he seems to be performing one of those functions, at least in a limited sort of way, but not the other one. That is, I don't know of an active investigation that he's cooperating with. And I do think that when the president of the United States is actively contemplating the illegal deployment of U.S. military forces in order to remain in office, you get awfully and uncomfortably close to the language of, particularly if he's contemplating not vacating the White House on January 20th, you know, you get into the lands that there are actually conspiracies, you know, sedition statutes that seem to get pretty close to. I'm curious how you evaluate, I don't want to accuse the president of a seditious conspiracy yet, but I do think that's a very unusual position to put a lawyer in.
Yes, for sure. There are positions that lawyers evaluate in the White House that are aggressive legal positions, but they're within even the very spacious boundaries that we assign to those kinds of interbranch disputes over what the law is, what presidential authority is. There's room for disagreement, and perhaps a White House counsel working for a president who has an expansive view of executive authority goes a long way with the president in the defense of those positions. But we're not in, again, in any unfamiliar place. When we're talking about something like what occurred in Watergate with Richard Nixon, who involved his White House counsel in a criminal cover-up, or we are in the Trump administration and there's reason to believe that the president is asking questions about how to subvert the outcome of a lawful election. And I'm going to come to this in a second. This isn't an illegal act, but I think it's relevant to the discussion. Continuously falsely messaging to the public about that election, I think we're not within familiar territory and we're not within spacious boundaries, or we're well beyond the boundaries that are spaciously normally set. I think that if the president is literally reviewing, and we don't know, we'll not know for some time, I suppose, what precisely is taking place in the White House now. But if he's reviewing all sorts of plans that, as you say, could be seditious and subversive of the electoral process, and, you know, actively engaging in a conversation that the counsel is a party to about pursuing those plans, that is just not normal. And it's not something, and this goes to Sarah Isger's point, that ought to be concealed from the public, or that a White House counsel should be prepared to countenance in that role. I think Don McGahn at one point made it very clear that if he was pushed even further to take certain actions he didn't want to take in relation to the Mueller investigation, that he would resign. And there does come a point where I think resignation is the appropriate course of action.
Yeah, so I while we were speaking, I pulled up the seditious conspiracy statute. And it's actually worse than I remember from the last time I looked at it only a couple of weeks ago. So I'm trying to imagine myself as Pat Cipollone listening to the president say, talking about refusing to vacate the White House or calling out the military to seize ballot machines, which apparently he's been urged to do by Mr. Flynn. And I'm thinking about this statute, which reads in relevant part, if two or more persons in any state and territory, in any state or territory, or in any place subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, conspire to... to oppose by force the authority of the United States, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or by force to seize, take, or possess any property of the United States, contrary to the authority thereof, they shall be fined, etc. You know, that's awfully close to what these reported conversations are said to be, right? We're gonna invoke the military authorities to seize state ballot counting machines, to, you know, not give up when the law requires us to give up. And I would just be really uncomfortable as an attorney sitting in those conversations, given the text, you know, leave aside my oath of office and what other, but given the text of a statute that carries a 20-year prison term associated with it.
Yes. I mean, I suppose the lawyer who is counseling furiously against this course of action, anything that, you know, might come within the terms of the statute, will say, well, I'm not uncomfortable in the sense that I feel personally exposed. I just don't know that I want to be associated with a conversation like right. this. And I don't want to be called in day after day into the Oval Office to have it one more time. And that goes to the question of where you draw the line. When Richard Nixon collected people, and again, these cases are different. I don't want to make them sound like they're identically the same. They're not. But when Richard Nixon was, you know, continually, by implication or otherwise, scheming to obstruct the law enforcement process directed at the complex of crimes that we call Watergate, and a counsel is there listening to conversations, say, about the payment of hush money, that counsel, even if the hush money were not paid, and by the way, in Nixon's case, the hush money was paid, but that counsel might say, these are conversations that should never take place in the Oval Office, and I cannot be the White House counsel to a president who's encouraging these conversations. I won't do it. I simply will not be a party to it. And I think that that is a choice that a counsel in that situation faces, that to uphold a certain understanding of what is expected of the occupant of the high office and the people who serve him or her in that position. And I just wanted to say something briefly on a non-legal point. I just want to say something about Trump's tweets and the lies he tells over and over again about the election. I don't believe, given his constitutional responsibility and the gravity of the charges that he's making up, charges made without sensational, absurd charges without any foundation whatsoever, the sole purpose of which is to persuade people that the election was not on the up and up, I believe that is something a White House counsel would have to ask some hard questions about. Questions about what does it mean, whether the president at some point, this gets us into the pardon conversation, is apparently dangling pardons out there in his public commentary, or in this case, undermining public confidence in the electoral process without any foundation whatsoever, literally making this stuff up and taking it from people who simply are completely incredible on these points. Do you say to yourself, well, I really serve the public best by trying to contain the situation, which also means that the public isn't in a position to evaluate what's taking place here? Now, we don't know everything the president is currently scheming to do. If you read this David Ignatius column in the Washington Post the other day, you know, he's suggesting that there's all sorts of other plotting that may be taking place there that sources tell him about. Well, we shouldn't be reading about it in the David Ignatius column. If that's taking place, people of good conscience in the White House should call the president out on it, refuse to continue to serve, and make it clear what's taking place.
So let's talk about pardons. The president has issued a spree of them. I think it's fair to say they are unusual in character, not in the sense that prior presidents have never issued self-interested pardons or rewarded friends or used pardons to cast investigations that they disapproved of in disrepute, but in the sense that the density of them devoted to doing that is extreme, and that this is a president who does seem, there does seem to be a group of pardons here that are intended collectively to undo the fruits of the Mueller investigation, as well as a group that are clearly intended to reward people who have been politically faithful over time. How do you understand this group of pardons and what they collectively say, and how does it interact with the question of the role of the White House counsel?
The president obviously is entitled to make judgments about pardons, even very ill-advised pardons that bring disrepute to the presidency and disrepute to the pardon process. President Trump presumably likes the pardon power, in fact, has lavished praise on the pardon power, because unlike some of the other things that he would like to be able to do, like direct the Department of Justice to pursue prosecutions of his political enemies, he doesn't have to worry about people putting up too much resistance. He's got wide berth to issue pardons, even if they're extremely self-interested. But the White House counsel has a responsibility to the institution. And so even again, taking into account how much latitude the president has to make decisions about the pardons that he or she issues, there has to be, once again, some limits on what a White House counsel would be prepared to enable if, in fact, he or she takes seriously the responsibility they have to the office, to the institution, their counsel to the presidency, yes, to that particular occupant who appointed them, but to the presidency. And so, first of all, I would say, those pardons that appear to be intended to be vengeance against Mueller, well, that's extremely unattractive. Obviously, Trump, and he's not the only one, had very bad feelings about the Mueller investigation. He might have thought, in some alternative universe, might have argued coherently, there really was unfairness meted out to some of these individuals, and he was prepared to remedy that unfairness. But I would also say that in some of these cases, the pardons appear to be the culmination of a long process that was played out in public outrageously, of giving people who were in the criminal justice process and who were expected to cooperate with law enforcement reason to believe that if they didn't, the president would ultimately reward them. The dangling of pardons, it's sometimes called. People can have differences of opinion about how explicit it was, but certainly whether you look at some of what Trump said in tweets and the timing of those tweets, and you can find obviously this discussed at length in the case of Paul Manafort in the Mueller report, there's a real impression that one gets that he was making it clear to people that if they just sat tight, if you will, hung in there, had guts, that they might, in fact, benefit from presidential mercy. That came out of his own mouth. And as I said, it came out of Giuliani's mouth. And if I'm the White House counsel, I'm going to be very concerned about that, because this could very well be, we don't know because we don't know all the facts, an indication that there was some understanding in place. And whether a crime was actually committed, i.e. a pardon was issued for a corrupt purpose, certainly that's an investigable issue. And the overall appearance of it sits very, very badly with that office. I mean, it is a stain on the presidency. I would say a White House counsel has every reason to say, I don't know that I can defend again this activity in this particular context, given the way in which these pardons may have been used.
Okay, so I want to bring that down to brass tacks. You're Pat Cipollone now, and the president comes to you having done all the pardon dangling that he did with Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort, and he says to you, I think it's time to issue the pardon in these cases. And first of all, let's say he says privately what he says publicly, which is, you know, it's so unfair the way they were treated. And on the other hand, you're very aware, because among other things, it's sitting there in the Mueller report, and it was all done in public anyway, that he did this pardon dangling, that they both, in fact, whether on the strength of it or just coincidentally, reneged on their plea agreements, that they both withheld cooperation from Mueller, at least for a time, Manafort quite clearly, and Flynn a little bit less obviously. You know, so you have this pattern in which the pardon is dangled, the cooperation is agreed to, and then in the face of pardon dangling, reneged upon. The Mueller investigation is in fact frustrated, at least in the Manafort case, by the absence of cooperation. And now the president wants to actually all for totally legitimate reasons, because he thinks the whole thing was very unfair, issue the pardons. And you look at it and you say, well, on the one hand, he has the prerogative of issuing pardons. And on the other hand, you know that history. Like, what's the right way for a White House counsel to handle that situation?
I wish I had the right answer to this. And it's one of the reasons, again, why sometimes I want to be very careful about what I say about what the White House counsel should or should not have done in a particular situation without complete facts. I was thinking as you were saying this, well, this would be a conversation I might want to have with the president's personal attorney. Is it a conversation you want to have with Rudy Giuliani? I suspect that wouldn't be terribly fruitful. I think it's a conversation nonetheless with the president that in effect suggests that, number one, you're going to issue pardons that raise a serious potential concern about the corrupt use of the pardon. It's going to bring back into the history and potentially induce some inquiry, some further inquiry into the history here. Who said what to whom, with what intention to generate what kind of expectation of a pardon? And it's a bad look.
It's a really bad look.
Even if you set aside the potential that it becomes a legal problem or the potential for congressional oversight, as there was in the aftermath of the Clinton pardons, it's a very bad look. And you're the White House counsel. And again, the question is, where do you draw the line? You may disapprove of certain kinds of pardons, but that doesn't mean you oppose them. But this seems to me at such an elevated level of concern, you'd have reason to draw a pretty sharp line. And let me add to that, by the way, the pardons that were issued to Republican members of Congress, former Republican members of Congress, who were, frankly, with one exception, and there was some controversy, I don't know that the controversy was very real, generally non-controversially convicted of financial crimes. And he pardoned them with no explanation other than apparently friends of theirs in the Congress, he says members of Congress, had suggested to him that he should pardon them. So he did. So there's one particular explanation. It is in Chris Collins's case, not so much in Duncan Hunter's case, but at least in Chris Collins's case, there's no indication of any reason for the pardon other than he's a Republican.
He felt like it.
He felt like other Republicans told him you should pardon him. So he did.
So to go back over the last couple of weeks, and you're making me feel sorry for him, actually. You have this poor man who is involved in, first of all, the awful atmospheric question of, like, should I be taking advice from Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, right? You've got a series of conversations that I don't think I'm being hyperbolic here, that if I were Pat Cipollone, I would feel compelled to warn the president about what the law of sedition actually is in the United States, right? That if you were actually to do these things or plan these things, you would be treading perilously close to the line and maybe crossing the line of a seditious conspiracy. You would have to be advising on, and your office would have to be preparing the documents for, a series of pardons that range from the tawdry to the arguably completing of a pattern of obstruction of justice. Mm-hmm. It's a tough situation.
It is. What comes to mind, and that's why, again, in the absence of full information, I'm hesitant to pass too ready judgment. But I do think there's enough on the public record to at least have us talk sensibly about White House counsels and other senior aides in the White House. But I was focused on the White House counsel because we're dealing here with rule of law issues in the absolute purest sense of the term. What it is, what obligations they owe to the rest of us in that role. And it is not the role of personal attorney or political attorney of the president. It is an institutional role, and that was settled quite some time ago, even though there were some occupants of the White House counsel's office, like Bernie Nussbaum, who felt really strongly and argued, you know, eloquently that people don't understand the role and that they make it too simple. They simplify it too much by saying the White House counsel is a government attorney and not attorney to the personal president. But consider that Bernie Nussbaum was thought to be much too much of a defense counsel by some critics thought. Nussbaum never agreed that he was too much of a defense counsel for Bill Clinton. You'll recall that after Deputy White House Counsel Vince Foster committed suicide, there was a tussle, and I think I'm being reasonably clear about the facts, but I'm doing this from memory, but there was a tussle over the lockdown that he ordered of Foster's office, which meant keeping some law enforcement from immediately examining the contents.
The Deputy Attorney General, to be precise.
Okay. And so
it was Phil Hyman, Deputy Attorney General, and Bernie Nussbaum kept him out of Vince Foster's office.
Yes. And on the theory that, you know, he was protecting the president as president, and that he wasn't actually obstructing a criminal investigation. Well, at the end of that year of Nussbaum's, or of a full year, I think it was, of Nussbaum's very troubled tenure, he resigned. He was asked to resign. Well, compare poor Bernie Nussbaum, all of that leading to resignation, with what White House counsels from McGahn to Cipollone have had to deal with, and the decisions they've had to make, and the choices that they made in not resigning in certain circumstances, and the effects of their not resigning, again, on public transparency, and frankly, even on sort of establishing standards for their office. And that's partly what this is about, is establishing standards for the office. How does a White House counsel demonstrate that while absolutely professional, prepared to treat, as the White House counsel should, conversation with the president, confidence, and deal with difficult issues and give the advice that he or she should give with the knowledge that, you know, sometimes the president's going to be pushing the boundaries of his or her authority, et cetera, where is the limit? And I think that is the limit of continuing to serve while a president is exhibiting the kinds of behaviors that you and I are talking about here. Boy, compared to what they've gone through, what happened to Bernie Nussbaum?
It seems like a walk in the park.
Walk in the park.
So you do talk in the piece about one additional factor, which I want to argue in favor of Cipollone's position, which I just want to talk through for a minute, which is, you know, the White House counsel's office, unlike the attorney generalship, is not a subject to Senate confirmation. If he walks out the door, the president could appoint Rudy Giuliani or, God forbid, Sidney Powell to replace him. And there is no constraint on that, not even their ability to get them cleared, because the president can, as he showed with his son-in-law, can clear people by his own fiat. And so, you know, the argument for a mid-level DHS official, if I weren't here separating children from their parents, somebody else, even worse, would of Stephen Miller's choosing, would be doing it for me, always strikes me as a bad argument, because it's pretty rare that the mid-level or even top-level DHS official is saving the republic. But the person who is actually giving legal advice to the president of the United States personally is in a somewhat different position. And when the president's public flirtations with alternatives to that person are people who are evidently, you know, clinically impaired, whether it's the crazy conspiracy theories that Sidney Powell is issuing, or the unable to figure out which four seasons to stand at when you're delivering those, as Rudy Giuliani is, there is something to be said for the, hey, at least I'm not insane argument. And I'm curious how that figures into your thinking about, I mean, you give it its due in the piece, and I'm curious, you know, if Pat Cipollone called you up and said, Bob, look, I know it looks bad, but this really is a barbarians at the gate situation. How sympathetic to this argument should we be?
Again, up to a point. There's some dangers. Number one, the argument, if I were not here, somebody worse could take my place, can become very quickly a rationalization. And people have to scrutinize their own motives. I'm not speaking here about Pat Cipollone's motives. I don't know him, and I don't know I'm not speculating about his motives. One can imagine somebody using that argument just because they are very reluctant to give up their White House mess privileges and all the glories that come with holding the office. It's very easy to say, well, if I'm not here, somebody worse will come along. And then you are on a path toward enabling conduct you shouldn't enable. You're on a path toward bringing disrepute to your office, which you owe the public not to allow to happen. So I think there's a risk with that sort of argument, because it depends on how well you know your own motives for deciding to do that. And secondly, there are circumstances, I do think, where it's just important for people to know what's happening. It's not every day. It's not in the, I said, I'm from the very beginning here, there are wide, wide boundaries for argument within the White House about legal positions that the president can take and constitutional positions that the president can take. I'm totally sympathetic to that, even if I may violently disagree with, say, what Donald Trump's lawyers have to say on a particular subject. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the misuse of the pardon power for apparently corrupt purposes. That is to say, when I say apparently corrupt purposes, maybe not corrupt purposes, but certainly given in circumstances that would lead people to suspect that there might have been a corrupt purpose. That's serious business. And then, of course, this whole question of the president actively looking for a way to subvert the outcome of an election that he just was unhappy about because he lost it. I mean, those are extreme situations. And I don't think the normal, if I was here, I better keep this to myself and deal with it the best I can, because if I were here, were not here, someone worse would take my place. I don't know that that argument extends to these circumstances.
We're going to leave it there. Bob Bauer, thanks so much for taking time out to write this piece and to come on and talk about it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. As always, thank you very much for inviting me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our promotion director is you, the audience. So tweet about the Lawfare Podcast, share us on Facebook, and pin us on Pinterest. And for God's sake, leave us a rating and review wherever you found us. Our merch is available at the Lawfare store, and you know you want it. And as always, thanks for listening.